You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 9th, 2015. I'm Michael Brooks. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, just me. No Sam, no Matt, no one to drag me down. Just ably assisted by the very talented intern slash archivologist slash vice president of emerging market research slash global strategist slash vice president and Majority Report communications coordinator, Noah. Noah, how you doing? I'm all right. Are you up? Okay. I think, yeah, you're all right. On today's program, Kayvon Afshari, the Director of Communications of the Iranian American Council. Bear with us, folks. If there's any problem or anything, this is Noah's first time at the board. We got no one else backing us up today. If there's any problem, I think you can expect me to demonstrate a level-headedness and emotional maturity that is sadly lacking on this program when its main host is in charge. But that's right. Sam is about to start his vacation, about to go to Italy. Matt, his fake baby story continues. The saga of his supposedly pregnant girlfriend, putting in some air quotes for those of you listening. So it is just me, and on today's program, as I say, we're talking with Kayvon Afshari about the state of negotiations between the P5 plus one and Iran, that the deadline has been extended again. We're going to get into the details of that. Also on the program, Bernie Sanders saying the United States should apologize for slavery. Also try to get into China a little bit, have some sense of what's going on there. And Hillary Clinton, echoing Sam Steeter. And of course, on the fun half, you could take the iPad all the way down. On the fun half, I will certainly be wanting to hear from you, have your calls and IMs. And we're going to have a great show today. So just bear with us. I think Noah's handling it really well. I certainly have sympathy for someone who's learning the ropes of something technical. So bear with us. Enjoy. We will be right back in about 50 seconds with Kayvon Afshari.
My headphones up. It's pure. Nothing gonna stop me now.
Stillmatic.
I'm here. Time
fight free. Yeah, you know?
It's your world.
Yeah, will y'all.
Yo, all I need is one mic, one beat, one stage, one person front. My face on the front page. Only if I had one love, one girl and one crib, one God to show me how to do things. His son did it pure, like a cup of virgin blood mixed with 151. One sip will probably make me flip. See my name in the hieroglyphs, like Osiris and Isis. Parables written inside papyruses. Acknowledge it. We've been all tricked. Time to come out of it. Seeds watch us grow up and try to follow us. Police watch us roll up and try knocking us. One knee I duck. Could it be my time is up? With my luck, I got up. The cop picking. Bus stop glass bursts. A fiend drops a Heineken. Ricocheting between the spots that I'm hiding in. Blacking out as I duck back. Forget getting hit. This is my
half of it to everybody. Come on, little brothers is grown. The rats don't abortion your womb. We need more warriors soon. Sent from the stars, sun and the moon. And it's life of police chasers, street sweepers and coppers. Stick up kids with no conscience, leaving victims with doctors. If you really think you're ready to fly with my power, this is what Nas is about. Brothers, the time is now.
All I need is one mic. All I need is one mic. That's all I need. All I need is one mic. All I need. All I need is one mic. Yeah. All I need is one cup, one page, and one pen, one prayer. Tell God, forgive me for one sin. Matter of fact, maybe more than one. Look back at all the hatred against me. Touch all of them. Jesus died at age 33. That's 33. From 20 to 16 piece, that's 32, which means one of my thuns was holding 17. 27 hit your crew, 6 went into you. Everybody gotta die sometime. Hope your funeral never get caught up. Pain to go through the innocent, nothing is fair. Brothers roll up from wheelchairs, my heart is racing. Tasting revenge in the air. I let this all slide for too many years, too many times. Now I'm strapped with a couple of too many. If y'all people really with me, get busy, load up the. Do more than just hold it, explode it until you empty. There's nothing in our way. They boss, we boss. They rush, we rush. Try and feel it. I feel it in my gut that we take these dudes to war. Lie them down, cause we're stronger now. My people's, the time is now. All I need is one mic. That's all I need. That's all I need. All I need is one mic. There's nothing else in the world. All I need is one mic. That's all I need to do is stand, you know? All I need is one mic.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Kayvon Afshari. He is the Director of Communications at the American-Iranian Council. He's also the host of the Middy Show. And I need to say, by a full disclosure here, one of my other gigs is I am a research analyst, senior research analyst at the American-Iranian Council. So in addition to being friends, which I guess is typical for many people I interview, we're also colleagues. So with that out of the way, Kayvon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here. Sam's playing golf again today, isn't he?
Sam is not athletic enough for golf, but if you were kind of implying, you know, the certain maybe a laziness, that is true.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah. No, he's actually, Sam is on his way to a well-earned vacation.
Good for him.
Yeah, as is Matt. Matt has this whole made-up baby story going on, so he's been stringing days off. So
you're running the show yourself.
You know, whatever. You know, I can carry the mantle. It's fine. I'm the one who's fueled up with kombucha and yoga, so I'm good to go. So Kayvon, the deadline keeps being extended. At these negotiations between the P5 plus one and Iran, it seems to me that there's a lot of, these are nuclear negotiations. These are not full scale, you know, the relations between Iran and America, the relations between Iran and America and its neighbors. You know, this is not, there are a lot of other variables in the Iran and U.S. relationship. But fundamentally, it seems that the negotiations, that there seems to be this kind of ongoing injection of other issues into them in order to sort of complicate the process. So what I'm wondering is, we're seeing the extensions of the deadline continue to be extended. President Obama apparently has told an ally of his in the Senate that he is less optimistic now. That was reported this morning about reaching a deal. So what's going on in your view? Is it that we have an actual bottleneck on the technical questions that they're dealing with? These are highly technical negotiations about a nuclear program, right? So is the problem that,
yeah,
or are we getting into other issues about sanctions, about conventional arms, that are kind of muddying the waters several sides work towards an agreement here? What's your read on it?
Well, I think you're right that this is constrained specifically to the nuclear issue. It would, however, just as kind of a side note, I think concluding a deal would definitely have some reverberations, positive reverberations, sure, for broader U.S.-Iran relations, because it will have, you know, pretty much for the first time in 35 years, set a precedent by which, you know, a diplomatically negotiated settlement managed to peacefully resolve a very thorny, decade-long international issue.
Definitely.
And thus, because of that precedent being set, there is room for the U.S. and Iran to negotiate on other issues in which they both have a stake, all related to the security of the Middle East and North Africa. And that's something that I am in favor of seeing these two sides work together towards regional peace. On the issue of like what the bottlenecks are here, I think you're right also that it is, my sense is that they're dealing with highly technical issues here, and that is what's causing the consistent delays. And like I'm watching it on Twitter now, you know, because there's a bunch of journalists at the hotel where they're negotiating, and it seems like, yes, they won't conclude it today. They went back into another meeting like another hour ago or so, but it's looking like it's not going to be concluded today. But this is a really important point. If we're starting from the point that, you know, it probably is technical issues that are in the way and both sides do want a deal, then it's more important that I'm not too concerned about a deadline being extended for another day or another week, because it's more important that they achieve all, you know, perfect clarity in the negotiation phase rather than during the implementation phase have some disagreement. Because if they don't achieve that perfect clarity on these highly technical issues now or next week or in the next 2 weeks, and the two sides walk away with slightly different interpretations, that's going to leave too much room for one side to accuse the other of abrogating that agreement, which could lead the whole thing to fall apart. So I think it's fine. I think they should just keep on negotiating. You know, it'd be great if it's announced today, but if it's announced next week, that's fine as well. The other issues, like, so I think that's the primary bottleneck. I think the rest of it, like the domestic politics in the U.S., domestic politics in Iran, the other regional players are definitely a factor involved. But I don't believe that those factors, while significant, are enough to stop the U.S. and Iran and the other partners at the table from achieving what they want to do.
Right.
Certainly, like, Obama has to take Congress into consideration. But ultimately, the U.S. and Iran and the other partners, I think, have invested so much political capital in this process that it would be such a failure for them to just walk away from it.
Right, and that's actually the natural follow-up question. I want to get into the domestic politics.
Yeah.
I think we'll get into a little bit in the U.S., but actually we should get into it inside Iran, because that's talked about less, and that's pretty fascinating and important, and, you know, Rouhani is dealing with his own hardliners in pursuing this course. But that said, you know, it does seem to me that there's so many paradoxes of these negotiations. You know, I was talking with Ali Gareb a couple of, probably about 6 weeks ago, a couple months ago on this program, and I was saying, you know, there's an extraordinary paradox of, on one hand, people talking about Iran as if it's the moral and political equivalent of ISIS. And then at the same time, you're seeing pictures Netanyahu said that.
I was just going to say, Netanyahu's making that point exactly.
The main sort of silly PR tactic from Netanyahu, which actually really is frankly, I would think that Israel's PR people could do better than that. But at any rate, you know, there's something that's so just sort of, a performative contradiction of that talking point, that silliness, and then, you know, pictures of Kerry and Zarif, you know, walking around Switzerland together. It's ridiculous. So not that Iran, and not that there aren't very big differences, and not that Iran doesn't have many, many problems, and not that it's a rosy picture by any stretch of the imagination, but obviously it's not ISIS. That's ludicrous. So I guess the kind of follow-up question to that, and reflecting what you said before in terms of all the political capital that's been expended in these negotiations, is it more that, you know, while this particular configuration is in place, basically you have Obama, you have Rouhani, and we'll get to it more later, but clearly the supreme leader of Iran, Khamenei, has obviously signed off on this strategy, regardless of whatever rhetorical you know, sort of bombast he engages in. He clearly supports Rouhani and Zarif in this. It seems that as long as this arrangement is in place, you know, how do you step back from this? Are you just, you know, it seems to me that next week or all of a sudden the U.S. and Iran just going to go back to we hate each other and this is done and all of these negotiations and breakthroughs were irrelevant. That seems ridiculous. So what it seems like is, and I want to, you know, get your take on this, obviously the sooner the better, but really you're in a situation right now where if you kind of freeze time for another several months or a year, under this particular configuration, they're going to keep looking for a way to get to yes. And the danger is more what happens if it doesn't happen, and then we have a political shift in the United States and or Iran.
Exactly, exactly. And this is, I think, basically the timeline here. First, I want to say, I should say this early, I do think that they will reach a deal, by the way. It's not going to be today, it may be next week or 2 weeks, but I do think that they will reach a deal soon. I think the timeline on this basically runs until the end of the Obama presidency. I mean, he still has, you know, what, a year and a couple months. I guess January 2017 would be the inauguration of a new president. So there is still time. And I think as long as Obama's in office, as has his cabinet, and John Secretary is still serving as Secretary of State alongside Wendy Sherman and the rest of the team, I think that healthy deadline is still in place.
Okay, so let's move then to...
You asked about Iran, too, and I should comment on that as well.
Yeah, so, I want to move there. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, so I'll get... So you're right that, Khamenei has endorsed these. He's, you know, said that he's publicly kind of pessimistic about it, which I think is kind of a shrewd strategy, because if it falls apart, he can say he was pessimistic from the beginning.
Right.
But Zarif and Rouhani have totally expended their political capital on this. I mean, Rouhani made it kind of a point in his domestic agenda that he wants to finally resolve this issue. There are, of course, detractors in Iran, and these are, I refer to them as the revolutionaries. So these are the people in Iran who, and they don't like Zarif. When they summon him to the Majlis, which is Iran's parliament, they don't have very nice things to say about him for negotiating with what they refer to as the Great Satan.
Right.
Now, this block inside of Iran, they basically believe in the principles fundamentally of the Islamic revolution. And all of those principles, as you know, are enshrined in their document, the Constitution for the Islamic Republic. And in that Constitution, there are several principles that I think it's hard for them to reconcile those principles with reaching a negotiated settlement with the so-called Great Satan. So, for example, and I think your listeners should actually take a quick look at the Constitution, because they list, you know, scientific self-sufficiency as one of those principles, and the nuclear program would fall under that. Of course, they list neither east nor west, meaning that, you know, the Islamic Revolution took place at the height of the Cold War, and so they didn't want to ally with the communist bloc nor with the West, but rather to pave their own way. And then thirdly, I would say kind of they believe in this principle of standing up for the rights of oppressed peoples, and they view, through this lens, they view the United States as an imperial power. And thus, they're extremely suspicious of the United States, which makes it difficult for them to understand or to endorse negotiating with this power. And, I mean, unfortunately, over the past 35 years, there have been many instances in which that worldview becomes validated. You know, really unfortunate circumstances. I'll just quickly name a few of them, but you know, like the downing of the Iranian airliner in 1988, 8 years of support for Saddam Hussein. Even today, you know, on the nuclear issue, we saw for years, before the latest round of negotiations started, we saw, you know, at least three Iranian scientists assassinated, a fourth attack. We saw Iranian military sites attacked, cyber warfare. So this confirms that worldview for them. Of course, conversely, for the United States, they view Iran naturally as a very anti-American revolutionary power. And so it's everything from the hostage crisis to attacking American soldiers in Iraq that confirms their worldview. So there is this process of reconciling one's lens with which, you know, Iran views the U.S. and the U.S. views Iran, and reconciling that with a negotiated settlement to the nuclear issue. That's how I see it.
Right, and I think that, and I actually would love you to kind of get into it a little bit more on, in terms of domestic Iranian politics, because it's very fascinating and sort of important to tease out a little bit. So what it seems, because obviously even the quote-unquote moderate factions in Iran, led by President Rouhani and Minister Zarif, they would certainly, they would allow no one to question their revolutionary bona fides, right? So all of this
right.
takes place in the context of, we are, you know, fully paid up members of the Islamic Revolution. And in fact, I think it's quite clear that one of the reasons, just to give some history here, in the late 1990s, the Iranian people elected President Khatami, Khatami president, right? This was a guy who
yes.
really was, again, a full-fledged member of the Islamic Revolution, part of the leadership. But he was, I would go so far as to say, really like a liberal leader, and had a very
a deep reformist
yeah. leader. He had really interesting notions about a kind of global dialogue of civilizations,
mm-hmm.
And he was not trusted by the Iranian establishment, and he basically
right.
was marginalized. They were both afraid of him because of his immense popular support, which reflected desire for change in Iran. He was even put in situations where apparently, associates and people close to him were, had their human rights violated, maybe even killed by Iranian security services, and he couldn't even intervene and help them. The point being that, and then we went through the Ahmadinejad years, and he actually fell out with the Supreme Leader when he sort of went out and sort of strutted too much and,
that's right.
and kind of actually really tried to almost assert himself as almost more of just sort of a populist authoritarian type leader and not a loyal president in the Islamic Republic, which is fascinating and a little bit different from how he's perceived in the West. But with Rouhani,
okay.
you have a guy who is totally trusted by the establishment and very validated by them, but who also is a genuine, has reformist inclinations, but maybe more of a realist reformist. So
how are those guys
framing themselves in terms of counteracting the attack they're getting from the right, in terms of solidifying their bona fides while they pursue this course of negotiations?
Yeah, so I think on Rouhani, he's not quite a reformist. More the term that you describe him is more a moderate or a pragmatist. Because
right.
reformist, at least in Iranian politics, means a really specific thing that you're aligned with Khatami and the movement that he started. But that's
right.
kind of just a small technical point. But
no, that's important. No,
yeah,
that's
No, but it's yeah. important. Well, so I think on Rouhani, I mean, he served for years on the Supreme National Security Council, and
right.
that is very close to Ayatollah Khamenei. So you're right that in terms of his revolutionary bona fides, he has something specific that he can point to. And I think that in terms of selling this, you asked about selling this deal to the hardline, the detractors in Iran, those who are against the deal. And there are plenty of them. I mean, you can look at the IRGC leader,
right.
Mohammad Ali Jafari and some of his colleagues, one of the main writers for the Iran's hardline newspaper, Kayhan, his name's Hossein Shariat Madari. He's against it as well. And I think the way that they are selling it is by arguing that Rouhani and Zarif are selling it, is telling them that this is ultimately good for the Islamic Republic. And this gets to a concept that Ayatollah Khamenei talked about in September 2013, just before the JPOA, the Joint Plan of Action, came out on the nuclear issue.
Right.
And he referred to something called heroic flexibility. And what that means is that he was saying that the Islamic Republic needs to, to show heroic flexibility in order to get to this, to achieve this nuclear deal. And what he meant by that is that basically it's kind of, there should be a tactical change, meaning that they should make this deal because it's good for the Islamic Republic, but not lose sight of, their view of the U.S. as this, what they think as an imperial power, basically, but to maintain their suspicion, to be vigilant of U.S. designs for the region or what they perceive as U.S. intentions for regime change in the country, but that if there can be a change in tactics and to get this nuclear deal, it's good for the Islamic Republic, basically for two reasons. First, because, you know, what they get in return is sanctions relief, and they have been living under sanctions for a very long time, and those sanctions really were ratcheted up under President Obama, who passed the CISADA, the Comprehensive Iran Sanctions and Divestment Act, as well as the multilateral sanctions that came through the UN were under Obama as well, that really ratcheted up. I don't, on that point, I don't think that's why this round is successful, and we can come back to that. But it is certainly something that they want, is to have sanctions removed. And secondly, I think to kind of lower the temperature and the their threat perception of the United States, because again, whether you're a reformist or a moderate or a pragmatist or a revolutionary hardliner in Iran, all of them view the United States suspiciously in terms of its designs for the region and believe that it's interested in overthrowing their prized Islamic revolution.
Right. Although, again, and this is actually where maybe before we move towards the conclusion, let's talk about some of the quote-unquote side issues. And the reason I do call them, you know, side issues to a degree is because obviously everything is in play in these negotiations, from the future of the relationship between the U.S. and Iran to, you know, the nature of our policies in the Middle East, United States policies in the Middle East, to Iran's perception of the West. All of that is in play. But I do think it's important to really always disaggregate and make that distinction, say, no, this is a nuclear negotiation, period, because, you know, everything from human rights to conventional arms is going to get thrown in there as an attempt to sort of undermine what is a very clear and distinct track. Now, that said, let's get into some of these other issues. It seems to me that, in some respects right now, Iran and the U.S. have some very synchronized interests in the region. There's a very similar perception about ISIS. Certainly Iran, if anything, has responded even more quickly to ISIS. And actually, unlike us, has a much more direct, like, there actually are security implications for Iran because of ISIS.
Well, they share a border.
They share a border. Their sort of broader Shia community in the region is under threat because of ISIS. So that's one area. There's other areas where clearly, even though there's a difference in view, and certainly Iran has backed Assad in Syria fully, and even through all of his tremendous human rights abuses in his efforts during that civil war. Now that said, you know, we've have a great relationship with the Gulf states, who clearly have put money into Nusra and ISIS, and it seems to me that there are issues like with Syria, where even if we have a strong difference with Iran, it's crazy to not have Iran at a negotiating table in an attempt to reach settlements on these issues. So I guess when you talk about in Yemen, we're on the opposite side of Iran because, you know, we're basically backing Saudi Arabia and attacking Yemen because there's a group called the Houthis in Yemen, who's a Shia militia group, a Shia revolutionary group that is perceived to be backed by Iran. I think that's not as clear-cut as some people think it is. I think it's a bit more organic. And the Saudis are engaging in a tremendous air campaign in Iran and Yemen that's
causing a humanitarian catastrophe
barely even registering in the media right now. It's really horrific. And we're backing the Saudis.
Yeah.
You have these different pieces of the chessboard where, you know, we're aligned with Iran and ISIS. We have a disagreement about Syria, but any realistic policy in Syria is going to need to involve Iran, like it or not. And then in Yemen, frankly, we're backing a traditional ally in a really disastrous policy where we are, in fact, on the opposite side of Iran. And Iran might be adding to the temperature, but, we're not responding in the right way. So there's all these ancillary issues. And I just want your kind of take on how we should think about those issues, how we should approach those issues in a way that acknowledge that obviously they're there, but isn't used as a cudgel to undermine these negotiations.
Definitely. Okay, so because you said a bunch of things there. So first,
absolutely. So take it part by part. Go ahead.
Well, so first, you mentioned kind of like the side issues that get thrown in, like human rights and terrorism and Iran's regional policy and whether or not that should be germane to a conversation on the nuclear issue. I think it's certainly a conversation that should be had, but it definitely, I think we definitely both agree that should not preclude the U.S. and Iran and the other partners from achieving a deal. And there's a precedent for this also, because during Vietnam, there were Soviet-manned surface-to-air missiles shooting down U.S. pilots. The U.S. was bombing Soviet air defense, but Nixon still managed to negotiate the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, SALT I. So it's not, so this has been done before in which we have these broader...
And with much larger stakes. I mean,
And with much, I mean, these were two superpowers, ultimately. I think that for the U.S. decision-making process, those other issues certainly should still be on the table, but they should not be at the nuclear negotiating table. I don't think they really are. I mean, I think there are some groups who are trying to kind of use them as a pretext to object to the nuclear talks. I don't think that's really shifting the approach of our negotiators, at least. Maybe shifting the approach of some members of Congress, but in terms of Kerry and Obama, I don't think they're letting themselves lose sight of it. So, and then in terms of the broader regional implications of all of this, I want to be clear about it, but I also don't want to exaggerate it at the same time, because even, if, let's say, next week they come out and have a comprehensive nuclear deal, Iran sticks to it to the T, sanctions, the nuclear-related sanctions are removed. As we both kind of alluded to, there are still a lot of other issues that separate the U.S. and Iran. So they are certainly far from becoming allies as a result of this. The U.S. will continue to see Iran as an anti-American revolutionary state. Iran will continue to see the United States as an imperial state that wants to overthrow, like to see regime change in Iran. But there is some area for common ground, and in particular, ISIS, the fight against ISIS, stability in Iraq, stability in Afghanistan, the free flow of energy supplies, even on Syria, they are clearly not on the same side of this fight, and Iran has backed Bashar al-Assad, because they have their own foreign policy driven by their own strategic interests, too, and that has to do with a longer history of Iran's role in the region, and really started with the fact that, during the immediate aftermath of the Islamic Revolution, every one of the states in the region supported Saddam Hussein in his really brutal fight with Iran, except for Syria. So there is kind of a long-standing...
And Syria is a pipeline for Iran to Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is also...
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely true as well. But as I understand it, Iran is continuing to back Assad, but if they were brought into the negotiating table, some of them have stated that they back Assad, but they don't back him to any means whatsoever, meaning that they're willing to see a change in leadership in Syria, but they don't want to see a vacuum take place there too.
And they're right about that. And a leadership that would protect Alawites and Shias, which is a very important dimension of what's happening there. So they're right about that.
Right. Because if Assad was just removed and you had a vacuum there, I think that would be disastrous for everyone in the region, and the United States as well. So Syria is definitely a very complicated issue, and Iran is a major stakeholder in it. And I think the only way to get to a negotiated settlement there, which I'm not particularly optimistic about, I have to say, is inviting all stakeholders to the table.
Right. Absolutely.
Is there anything else we wanted to cover as well? I mean, maybe we should talk about it. Israel too, and the implications for Israel.
we only have a minute or two left. I mean, if you want to touch on Israel, I think that in some ways the same dynamic in Israel exists as well, where actually if you talk to the realists in Israel, who might have a little bit, you know, they might be generally a bit more hawkish. But I think that the, you know, amongst the realists and the actual security people, there's an understanding that this deal is a good idea. And I think the question kind of is, you know, is this just sort of crass domestic politics at this point with Netanyahu, or is this, because it's just very poorly calibrated. In other words, he could have, if he had hugged the administration through this process and been respectful, his concerns and his sharper lines, if he even has them, because I think that's the other kind of part of this, is that I don't think there's any lines for negotiation with him around this. But if he wanted a tougher negotiating stance and he hugged Obama, he would have probably been even more part of this process. So, I don't know. I mean, what else do you think is important to add about Israel and all of this?
No, I think you got everything. Yeah. There is actually, I want to make one quick point. I know you want to wrap this up. This is such an important point because there's been, I just sense a lot of intellectual dishonesty in the discourse in the United States and a lot of not very good reporting and framing of this entire issue. So two things. I mean, first, just for your listeners out there, I just want to recommend that they check out a lot of what Nima Shirazi has been doing on his blog. So if you just Google his name, it's been fantastic, like investigative reporting. He actually reads the reports and can kind of break down a lot of these myths that are unfortunately just so pervasive in the discourse now.
Yeah, Nima's an important person to read, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's pretty much always right on these issues, and unfortunately I think if more people would read, you know, that type of reporting, this huge nuclear issue would not have metastasized to the extent that it has, because it's really been exaggerated. But the main myth that I really want to dispel here is this argument that sanctions, these biting sanctions were what brought Iran to the nuclear table, because that's just patently not true. Iran cares about removing sanctions, certainly, but Iran's been at the table since 2002, 2003, I mean, Iran was at the table for a long time negotiating on this. There's two reasons I see why this latest round is proving more successful than previous rounds. Number one, you know, for 8 years you had Ahmadinejad, and his rhetoric was ridiculous, and just from an optical perspective, the U.S. couldn't have been openly negotiating with him.
Right.
They did privately, but they did have secret talks with him with his people in Oman, by the way. But much more importantly, and this doesn't get talked about by, you know, the Washington Post or even the New York Times, who I think have been somewhat disingenuous on this, is that the U.S. shifted from years, almost a decade of a policy of zero enrichment to finally a policy of limited enrichment. And it's once that shift took place, which really is not a concession either. I mean, this is outlined. I think, again, your listeners should read the NPT and look at Article 4 of the NPT, which outlines Iran's inalienable right to produce nuclear power for peaceful purposes. So that's not really a concession to say that, you know, that the U.S. shifted from a position of zero enrichment to limited enrichment. Right. And that, I think, is so important, because if you start, and I'll wrap this up, but if you start from the point that you think that sanctions are what brought Iran to the table, then that leads to a very dangerous conclusion, which is that, well, we should just ratchet up sanctions.
Absolutely.
The historical record does not bear that out at all. And I think that needs to be a much bigger part of the discussion.
I think certain factions within both sides have been seeking some type of deal and had some sense that this dynamic does not work. I think arguably even with Rafsanjani since the late 80s, early 90s, and even somewhat during Ahmadinejad. You're absolutely right. And there's a lot of homework for the listeners that you've given them, Kate. They have to read the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They have to read the Iranian Constitution. We're keeping it very highbrow here today. I hope everybody has a July vacation coming up so they can catch up on this stuff. But Kayvon Afshari, my friend, my colleague at the American-Iranian Council, I think you did a great job breaking this down for everybody, and I really appreciate your time.
Thanks. It was fun.
All right, great. See you soon.
See ya.
Bye. Okay, everybody. We are going to move pretty shortly into the fun half, where I got sound. I got stories. You call me up, you IM me, I'll do an impression for you. All right? All right? It's all on tap. So if you want to call and join in on the fun, I would, of course, love to take your phone call. I think Noah would love to take calls as well. Noah would probably, if you have any questions for Noah, if you want to know about how abusive this work environment is, you know, boom, call him up. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You want to debate? I'll deal with libertarians too. If you're one of these, you know, new atheist people and you insist on, you know, still do the whole Muslim thing, I can do that. Or if you just want to have a nice chat, I'm available. The IMs are on, they're fired up, so ready to take those. We have a lot for you in the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today. You know, it's a special thing. I know people who work at organizations that are a lot more capitalized, that, you know, but the truth is that they have to think. Even if it's totally, you know, as good as it could be and no one's directly looking over their shoulder or anything, you have to think. When you rely on your money, your sponsorship, and your funding from a small amount of people, you just have to take a different calculation for things. The Majority Report's really special in that way because you are our bosses. And for less than a dollar a day, less than a cup of coffee, you can support this show. You know, we're growing. We have some new podcasts coming in the pipeline. Really excited about that. The Indiegogo campaign was a great success because of you, and we're moving along. Sam and I, it looks like we're definitely going to be doing that Dennis Miller, Adam Carolla podcast, which will be pretty entertaining. And there's some other stuff coming along as well. So do it. Become a member today. Leave us a review on iTunes. That helps us. And write about how much you like me. I think Sam has frankly been getting too much praise. You know, it's not healthy for him. Matt. Write something good about Matt. He's about to be a father, for God's sake. Or so he claims. But seriously, if you write us a review on iTunes, even if it's like one sentence and you give us a star, that helps a ton. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at majority.fm. Share our YouTube videos. Help inject us into the conversation. We will see you. Download the Majority Report app. JustCoffee.coop, Majority Report Blend, free shipping, whole bunch of other things I'm probably not remembering, but there's a lot of ways to support the show. We appreciate everything you do, and members, we will see you in the fun half where we will take your calls and your IMs, and I'll get through some more stories. All right, see you in the fun half.